What led up to the economic problems of 2008? It was quite an impact on this country and around the world. Well, it was primarily driven by the housing bubble. In Northern California, at the bottom in 1997 until 2005, housing prices tripled. In the late 1990s is where a lot of this began. Most people don't realize that part, because at that time they were trying to promote home ownership among minorities, and so they said to the banks, you need to lower your standards, and they started suing them and saying, lower your standards or we're going to sue you. And so they started giving out loans, home mortgage loans, to people who couldn't afford them. And of course this would stay on the books for a while, and then it put a little pressure on the banks later on. Then came extreme deregulation, where they wouldn't even check on the loans to see if the income matched what you put down on your application. So those became known as liar loans. And then what they did after that is they took that debt and they mixed it with something else and they sold it off and got a rating on it. That was good. And pretty soon that debt was spread around the world. And it was like a disease that started taking across the world because of what we did back then. So there's a lot to the story that most people don't know about, but it was all bad in the end. And then in 2009, we thought, okay, let's spend more money and let's spend our way out of it. And the federal debt increased 50%, and it's now $16 trillion. And we spent ourselves almost to the point of bankruptcy. And then this brought everybody out of the woodwork. Because, of course, times like this is when everybody starts attacking our economic system. And so Occupy Wall Street protesters started coming out and all around the country. And why are they out there? Well, they have a goal, and their goal is a revolution. They want this country to be a communist country. They have 13 demands. Most of them are free things from the federal government. All loans are to be forgiven. Everywhere. They want a minimum wage of $20 an hour, free college education for everybody, and it goes on and on and on. They haven't figured out where all that money's coming from, but that's what they want. So there's an organizer of a Greensboro, North Carolina movement, and he has three quotes. First one is, we're the International Socialist Organization. Our goal is to raise political consciousness to build a revolutionary party and work for a revolution here in the United States, end quote. Next one is, quote, the problem is capitalism. We need a new system that's going to put people first and put profit back to the wasteland of history, end quote. Third one, socialism is a solution. We need a society where everything is produced to meet human needs and wants rather than to make money off of them, speaking of people. End quote. But the Occupy Wall Street protesters really need to kind of get a reality check, talk to those who have actually lived under communist regimes, and they might learn a few things. There was a professor, Dr. Roger Butters. He has a PhD, and it's entitled Teaching the Benefits of Capitalism. And he says China went through a terrible time when they stopped allowing capitalism. Following World War II, Communist Party abolished most forms of private property ownership, eliminated the rule of law, and when you do that, that means whoever's in charge, that's what you go by, not the rule of law. Competitive markets were outlawed, and then in the 50s and 60s, the standard of living dropped to below the level of the Ming Dynasty. You know, an employee of mine was from China, and he was a little on the younger side in this group, and so he was in the transition period. And he said he was sent to the farm to be re-educated, to learn what physical labor was like. And it says most college students and professors were sent to the farms, and the ones that were in charge were the Communist Party leaders. If you were a Communist Party member, doesn't matter how smart you were, how good you were, you're in charge. Didn't work out too well. And then Mao Zedong died. Deng Xiaoping, remember him? Mr. Armstrong used to go visit him. He concluded that if people, the Chinese outside China, could create wealth, then they could do it inside China as well. And so he started this methodical process of introducing capitalism back into China. They started trading with other countries. And then they allowed investments and private property laws. And competition was permitted and entrepreneurialism was encouraged. And in 30 years, the standard of living in China increased eightfold. China learned the hard way that communism doesn't work. And now they're one of the most capitalistic countries in the world. So what I want to do is cover what type of an economic system does God have? So let's first define economic systems. Douglas North, he has a Nobel Prize in economics, says that capitalism has four institutions, social institutions, private property rights, the rule of law, competitive markets, and entrepreneurial behavior. Whereas communism would not be allowing these things, and so everything is owned by the state and distributed evenly to everybody. Karl Marx once said, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. So that means you can work as hard as you want. You're not going to get anything more than anybody else. It's all even. So why would anybody want to work harder than anyone else? And that's one of the problems with communism. Now, capitalistic and socialistic systems have taxes on income, property, and sales, but it's a matter of degree when it comes to socialism. With property taxes, it's one of the worst taxes around, because when you retire, you own your house, you could still lose it if you don't pay taxes on it. If you look back at the history in the 20th century of this country, the top income tax rate has varied dramatically. Back in the 20s, 1925 to 1931, the top rate was 25%. And then they increased it. And it jumped up so that during World War II, the top rate was 94%. Now, why would anybody want to work if you're paying 94% of your taxes to the government? And so that reminds me of the old income tax form. Maybe you've seen it. First line is, how much money did you make? Second line is, send it in. And that's the way it was back then, 94%. They dropped it to 91% after the World War, and then down to 77%, right up until 64, they dropped it to 77%. And then President Reagan came into office, and it was dropped to 50%. And then 38.5%. So it's really gone across the board, the top rate at least, over time. And so they kind of approached the levels of socialistic countries in Europe. You know, we met an elder in Norway, and he had a business. And he had to live 6 months out of the year in the Canary Islands because of taxes, so that he wouldn't be considered, you know, maybe a member of the country. But here he was, having to leave because of taxes. I think he was also one of the individuals that Mr. Armstrong had to make a decision on because of, do you pay tithes on your gross or your net? You don't have much left if you're paying tithes on your gross. In fact, you go negative if you're living in Norway. So let's look at God's economic system as found in the Bible. We're going to start with ancient Israel and God's taxes. Let's go to Leviticus 27, verse 30. Leviticus 27, verse 30. It says, and all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord. So it is holy to the Lord. So the seed is to be the grain. So you harvest grain, you make bread out of it, you harvest fruit from trees, you tithe on that. Verse 32, and concerning the tithe of the herd or the flock of whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. It's kind of hard to break up an animal into parts. So you got to have whole animals. You got to tithe on those. You got to have 10 to tithe on 10%. So the tenth one is one that you tithe on. So this is first tithe. 10%. That's not very bad. I mean, it's not very hard to give, 10%. Now, let's go to Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. Something that you should have been doing over this past year. Chapter 14, verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year, and you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, and your oil, of the firstlings of your herds, your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. And then it talks about if the journey is too long, convert it to money. This is second tithe. This is not the same thing as sending in 10%. For instance, if you're paying taxes to the government, you send it in. This you keep yourself and you spend. You just have to save it. Second tithe. So it really doesn't count in terms of comparing it to taxes. Now let's go to verse 28. It says, at the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow are within your gates, may come, eat, and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So here's the third tithe, taking care of the poor, the widows. And so since this is every third year, and it's actually every third year in a seven-year cycle, it comes out to about 3%. So add the two together, you got 13%. That's not bad. Compare that to the best top tax rate in the country, and it's half of that. So 13% total, that's all God's really requiring you over an annual period of time, averaged out. So God's tax system is tithing, it's flat. You pay the same percentage no matter what your income. It's not progressive, 13% basically. And it's not the tax rate of a socialistic system. 10%. Now, God did warn Samuel to tell the people that if they had a king, the king was going to ask for 10% more. So that's where you get into true taxes, and that would, of course, increase it up another 10%. And, of course, it's gotten worse than that over time. If you think about poverty today in this country, what's the cause of most poverty? Well, a lot of it is single mothers. And if you think about God's law, if you keep God's law, then you don't have so very many single mothers. It protects you from poverty. So people stop living together before marriage, stop having divorces, then you have an intact family. You have less poverty, and you also have less crime. Look at how much money is spent on prisons. Now, all economic systems have some provision for the poor. And God's economic system uses third tithe, as we read in Deuteronomy. But he also has something else to take care of, a basic level dealing with the poor, found in Leviticus 19. So let's go to Leviticus 19, verse 9. He's speaking to the farmers. He says, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. So don't go back up and pick up all the little pieces that you find on the ground. You shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor, the stranger. I am the Lord your God. So this kind of takes care of a basic level of necessity for food. You can go in and glean. Now, if you come over in, I don't know, maybe it's a week or so from now, you might be able to glean some grapes from my vineyard. Because I don't go out and pick every single grape. But if you remember, Ruth was doing this. She was gleaning from the fields of Boaz. And, of course, Boaz was blessed because he was following this law. He was doing what God said. And she had food enough to make bread. She could gather enough grain for more than a loaf of bread in a day. Of course, today we have something somewhat similar in one sense, and that's senior gleaners, because they go out and get produce as well from the farms, and they get food from the food industry as well, and they help out poor people with that. Now, let's look at God's bankruptcy plan and his principles of private land ownership. You know, many people today spend more than they have, and that gets them into deep, deep trouble. And back in ancient Israel, there were still people who got into trouble economically, and they had to figure out a way to get out of it. And so God has a system for bankruptcy as well. And so these people would have to borrow money. And so to pay it back, they had to do work. And they also had a second option as well. So let's go to Deuteronomy 15, where God has this principle brought out, Deuteronomy 15 and verse 1. This allows the economy to be refreshed when you cancel debts. It says, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. So it's canceled. The debt is canceled at the end of 7 years. And so if you loan something to somebody, you had to keep that in mind. But you knew that at the end of 7 years, that's it. It's over with. So you didn't have these long, long loans. So 7 years was it. And if you owed a lot of money, you could do something else as well, found in Leviticus 25. Let's go to Leviticus 25 and verse 8. This is the year of the Jubilee. Well, not this year. It's talking about the Jubilee. And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years, or 49, 7 Sabbaths, which comes out to be 49 years. And then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. That's the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year, proclaim liberty through all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. So what happened there is you leased your land out for up to 50 years. It could be less. And you're leasing your land out for a purpose. So the person leasing it was doing it for a reason. And then it says, let's continue on down. Verse 13, in this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession, and if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not oppress one another. And then it gives the principle of making sure you count how many years you have left until the Jubilee. Because it's according to the number of years of crops he shall sell to you. And so that's what it's based upon. You're leasing the land. If you were one that was leasing it, you would want to plant crops and make money off of the lease. And you had until the Jubilee year, or there was something else. So let's go to verse 23. It says, the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. And it says, in all the land your possession you shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor, sells some of his possession, and his kinsman redeemer comes and wants to redeem it, you have to redeem it. And if the man has no one else, then he gets to redeem it. So he comes up with the money, he gets to buy the land back, pay back what's owed, and the land goes back to him before the Jubilee year. And it's based upon the number of years since its sale, which is common sense, you know, it's proportionate. And then you get to return to your land. Now, let's go to verse 29. If a man sells a house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it is sold, within a full year. So in a walled city, it's treated differently than the land. So it's like buying a condo in some city, and it's more treated like a possession. If it's not redeemed within a year, then the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to him who bought it, and it shall not be released in the Jubilee. So you could buy and sell houses in cities, and it's treated differently than the land. And if you go on to the next verse, it talks about houses of villages outside the walls is treated similarly to the land. But then it says in verse 32, the cities of the Levites and the houses in the cities of their possessions, the Levites may redeem at any time. So their houses are treated much more like the land. And so it comes back to them eventually. The Levites do have that. They get those houses back in the year of Jubilee. And they cannot sell the common land outside that as well. So what this did for people was it reset everything on debt. It allowed people to actually have a form, a way to make a living, even in hard times. You had land and you could plant crops, make money, or at least have food from it. And that really does help you. If you go back to the time of the Depression, if you had a farm, you did much better. My father did not have a farm. He was a child at the time. And he had days where he only had water and soda crackers to live on. So at least if you have a farm, you have food. And you're not starving to death. Let's go to Exodus 22. Exodus 22 in verse 14. Where it talks about another principle. So, to recap this area, you have a bankruptcy plan, and you also have proof here that the land is privately owned in God's economic system. So, Exodus 22, verse 14. We're going to go through just one principle here brought out about animals. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he shall surely make it good. So the principle being brought out here is, let's say you had a mule or a horse or something and you wanted to work your property. You borrowed it from your neighbor. And the neighbor was not there, and the animal gets injured, you're responsible for it. If the neighbor came over and you rented your neighbor and the animal, and the animal gets injured, he's responsible for it. So that's the principle brought out here. But I also want to look at it from the standpoint of you own animals, private ownership. So God's economic system allows private ownership of animals and land. And so when you look at this, that's a principle of capitalism, not communism. And you also have indentured servants. And indentured servants means employees that work for you. They're not slaves. And if you go and look at back at Leviticus 25, verse 39, when you have time, the principles brought out there have to do with indentured servants, not slaves. And I actually had an ancestor who came to this country in the 1680s. He didn't come the normal way, although it may have been more normal back then. He was visiting from Sweden, he went over to London, England, to study mathematics and English. He got knocked over the head, put on a boat, shipped over to the America, into Virginia, and he had to work 5 years to work off his passage. Then he was free to go. So he was an indentured servant, 5 years, but he wasn't treated like a slave. You know, he was just an employee basically that couldn't go anywhere. So that's an indentured servant. Now let's look at the New Testament. Here's this in Acts 2, verse 44 is a scripture that's brought out, and they try to prove communism through this. Acts 2, verse 44. So just after Pentecost. It says, now all who believed were together and had all things in common. And they sold their possessions and goods and divided them among all, as anyone had need. And they continued daily with one accord in the temple, breaking bread from house to house. They ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. So, if you look in the scriptures above, you had 3,000 people converted. So really, you had to have a way to take care of people because they wanted to be together for a while after their baptism and conversion. And so this is a way to do it. And you don't see this necessarily after that. People had to live and have a way of making a living after that. So this was a temporary thing. This was not communism. Plus, people thought that the end was coming very, very soon. So at least temporarily, they thought, okay, let's stay here. It's exciting. Let's go to 1 Timothy 5, where we have a principle brought out about widows. 1 Timothy 5. And verse 3. It says, honor widows who are really widows. So there's widows and then there's widows. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents. For this is good and acceptable before God. So in other words, there's widows who have family and widows who don't have family. So the widows who have children and grandchildren, the grandchildren and the children are supposed to take care of the widow. That's the principle that's brought out here. Now, verse 5, she who is really a widow, left alone, trusts in God and continues in supplication and prayers night and day. She has a lot of time on her hands. She doesn't have a husband, she doesn't have family, and so she can pray. And then in verse 8, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Those are strong words. So you're supposed to take care of your family. And you have to provide for them. And this is a very strong principle that's brought out today. I mean, that should be brought out today because it's a principle that many young men don't know about or don't seem to be thinking about, that they need to provide for their family. You know, we lived next door to a family with, started out with 6 children and became 8. It's a Catholic family. And the father had a pretty good main job, but he also had to have a second job to take care of all those children. So he worked as a barber on weekends. So he did whatever it took to provide for his family. In verse 16, if any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows. That's a principle we use today. The relatives are the ones that are supposed to take care of the widow, unless the widow has no family. And then they have to rely on the church totally. So this is right here in 1 Timothy 5. And that way the money can be distributed more evenly to people who actually have the need and have no other means of support. And this is third tithe. It takes care of the poor, the widows, and the fatherless. So God expects people to work, take care of the family, and the state does not take care of you. And this is a feature of a capitalistic economy. It's family-based. Now let's go to the economy in the world tomorrow. So God's laws are the same that he'll use the same laws in the world tomorrow as he used in ancient Israel. But let's go to Micah 4:4 to look at a millennial scripture. Micah 4:4. Very famous scripture. Everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree. So what do you notice in there? It says his vine and his fig tree. That means you own the vine and the fig tree and you own the land that it's on. Private ownership of land. That's going to be in the world tomorrow. It's not going to be communism, socialism. And no one is going to make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. So, you're going to have land once again. It's going to be given to families. Private ownership of land. It's not going to be the state of Israel's fig tree and vine. During the millennium, God is going to divide up the land of Israel into 12 tribes again. The horizontal boundaries that go across the land. And down a little bit below the middle, is going to be the area where the temple is. And King David, of course, as I mentioned, has land on either side of the temple. And so within those 12 tribes, you have families, just like at the time of Joshua. And so the families are going to have land that will be allotted to each of the families. Now, one of the questions that keeps coming up is, after 1,000 years, what's going to happen? And we're going to have to leave that up to God, or maybe we'll be given that responsibility. Because you keep expanding, either that or you keep dividing. You take your land and say, I'll divide that up for my kids and grandkids. Pretty soon you divide it up. Well, I don't think God's going to keep dividing it up, so he's going to have another way to expand out from there eventually. But the point is, there's going to be land for people to live on. And they will have a means of support, and it's going to be even better than that because of the blessings that occurred during the millennium. And, of course, you won't have to pay for the military. That's one part of your federal budget because Jesus Christ is your protector. You don't need an army, a navy, marines, nothing, no air force, because Jesus Christ protects you. And so also people are not going to be sick. No prisons. You don't have to worry about prisons. And that's a huge part of the state budget here in the state of California. And so Jesus Christ is going to have a world economy that's going to be spread around the world. And one of the things that is going to happen is the way things are produced is going to be a little different. Now today, if you look back over time, automobiles are one example that I use, quality has not exactly been the best in the past when you look at cars. And so you're going to have much better quality products. Now, the quality supposedly has improved over the years, but I remember back in the 60s, you had to buy a new car every few years because the engine would break down, the transmission would break down, or the repairs would cost so much, pretty soon you said it's time to get a new car. Whereas now, cars can last, 10 years is not a problem at all. We finally got a car that lasted 10 years and more without any problems at all. No repairs, nothing. And I like it when there's good quality. And what happens when you have good quality? You don't throw out so many things, do you? Parts. You don't have to keep getting parts. Things don't break down. They don't go into the landfill. Now look at the landfills today. They eventually started having to improve landfills so you protect the pollution that comes from them. But God's not going to allow pollution as well, because if you look at what's happened now, you go out into the middle of the ocean and you have all this plastic that's accumulated. It's almost like an island of plastic. And some of it breaks down. It's under the surface. Others floating on the top. Each of our oceans has that in between the circulation patterns. And so God's not going to allow that, because he says he's not going to allow anyone that's going to hurt or destroy on his holy mountain. And so if you look at cars, you know, I can go back and think of, I had a car back in 1979, and 60,000 miles, it had to be repaired, and then it had to be repaired again at like 20,000 miles later. And I finally said, that's it. Let's get rid of this thing, get another car. Only I didn't quite learn my lesson until about 10 years ago. And then quality is one of the issues. You also companies won't be allowed to do false advertising. And so when you're comparing apples to apples, you really will be comparing apples to apples. And if you've ever had, think back to all the things you've bought over the years and they've broken down and you throw them in the trash. Or you go and say, I want to repair this. And you find out it costs more to repair than to buy a new one. And that's not going to happen in the millennium, because it's going to be built so well, you won't have to repair it in the first place. And the parts will be easier to get as well. You also won't have monopolies. Go to the airport. What happens? They have food there. and it costs more money because they know you can't go anywhere. Airport food. Also, when you look at farms, farmers won't be allowed to feed their animals growth hormones. And then everybody's on the same level playing field, you know. They won't fatten up their animals more than somebody else. And you also won't have these animal byproducts that started the mad cow disease. And if you look back, as far as I know, back in the 60s, nobody was doing that. And eventually, somewhere along the line, they got this smart idea, let's save money. And then even the universities started doing research, apparently, and they started feeding their animals animal byproducts. Well, they're not supposed to eat that. And, of course, it causes problems. But farmers won't even have to do that anyway because of all the blessings that occur in the millennium. If you look at the vitamins and minerals in the fruits and vegetables, they are half of what they were in the 1960s because the land is so depleted now. And so with the 7-year land Sabbath, that will restore the soil as well. And then everything's going to have the vitamins and minerals that they're supposed to be having because it's going to be a lot more like the Garden of Eden. Let's go to Isaiah 30 and verse 23. Isaiah 30, verse 23. It says, then he will give the rain for your seed with which you sow the ground and bread of the increase of the earth. It will be fat and plenteous. And in that day, your cattle will feed in large pastures. Likewise, the oxen and the young donkeys that work the ground will eat cured fodder. So large pastures. If you look around the state of California, we don't have any large pastures that don't have to be irrigated. But God's going to change the weather. He's going to provide green grass again. And I grew up in the dairy capital of the world. Where was that? Back in the 60s. Where was the dairy capital of the world? Does anybody know? No, not Wisconsin. Southern California. Dairy capital of the world. No pastures there, right? It was just they brought in the feed and they had all the dairies. The Dutch dairy farmers came there. It's the dairy capital of the world. No grass. It's still the dairy capital of the world. More dairies there than anywhere else. Now, if you go up where we're going for the feast, we actually have a few dairies on near the coast. So it's kind of interesting, you know, to see a little bit more green grass. Go up to Oregon, green grass, more like the millennium. So God's going to provide a natural way to feed the cattle this way in the millennium. And the last scripture, Amos 9:13. Amos 9:13. Another famous scripture. Behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper. So they're going to have so many. I mean, you could actually do this in parts of Southern California if you irrigate, but you could start it early, in, well, maybe somewhere in February, plant something, harvest it, plant it again, harvest it, plant it a third time before it got so cold in the wintertime. Now, here, of course, you're going to have more rain, so it's going to be even better than that. And then the treader of grapes, him who sows seed, and the mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. And we're going to see that at the feast site, basically in Napa and Sonoma with all the wine grapes. In fact, they're going to be harvesting here soon, depending on what type of grape. So God's going to have a tremendous number of blessings, and things are going to change. But they're still going to be based on God's laws that you find in the Old Testament. So if you look at the whole economy that God has, it's based on the rule of law, God's laws. It's not based on the rule of man, or the law of man, I should say. It's family-based. The family unit is central to the success of God's economy, not the state. God's economy has private ownership of land and animals. And there is going to be entrepreneurialism and competition, but not cutthroat competition. God's economy is not communism, it's not socialism, and it's not crony capitalism. It's moral capitalism. So we look forward to the time when Jesus Christ returns to the earth and institutes his government over the entire world and brings along all the blessings that come along with it.